Okay, this is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes, who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. At that time, Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all of his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media and the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver strings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, and mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other. And the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink with no restrictions, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished.
The opening shot of a movie is considered often to be the most important part of a movie. After all, it's within these first few seconds of a movie that's the first thing that the audience sees. It sets the tone for the movie, and it begins to tell the story. And it's within those very first few seconds that the audience is either going to get hooked onto the story or they're going to start to disengage from the story. Movie critics claim that one of the better opening shots for a movie is from an old movie set in the 1950s, an old Western called The Searchers. Anyone ever seen the movie called The Searchers? Okay, a few of us. It starred John Wayne. And I actually have a clip of the opening shot of that movie. And so we're going to play that clip for you real quick. And I'm going to talk it through. Starts off with this black screen here telling us it's in Texas in the 19th century, but actually it's not a black screen. It's the inside of a house. The door opens, and the camera tracks through the door following the character, and we see this beautiful panoramic picture of West Texas. And she's looking down the way, trying to see that there's someone coming. And who is it that's coming? On a horse, it's none other but John Wayne, coming back home after being gone for 9 years. We can stop it there. Critics claim that's such a beautiful opening shot because it gives us this quintessential picture of the Old West, that we see this panoramic picture of the world of being in the West, where there are prairies and deserts and cowboys like John Wayne. And what makes this opening shot so good is that it immediately puts us into the world by which this story is going to be told. It introduces us to the world that we're getting ready to enter, which is the world of the Old West. I mentioned last week that in many ways the book of Esther is kind of unfolds like a movie. In fact, that's why we have all these movie props on the stage. Because as you read the story, it's almost like a story with various characters and actors and settings and all of those kinds of things. And like any good movie, this story of Esther has a good opening shot. And this opening shot is meant to, just like The Searchers, to help us understand the world that we're getting ready to step into. A world that is full of greed, a world that is full of power and authority, a world where at the center of it is a king by the name of Xerxes. Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, as he's called in Hebrew, was the king of Persia. His father was Darius, and his grandfather was Cyrus. Now, some of you might not know those names, so let me give you a brief explanation of that. If you recall in the Old Testament, the people of Israel, they, because of their disobedience, they were brought into exile. God removed them from their land, and they ended up having to go and live in the land of the Babylonians. Well, the Babylonian Empire was taken over by the Persian Empire. And at that time, Cyrus was the king of Persia, the place where every cat wants to live. Persia. I got that from Luke Vickers, okay? But Cyrus was a good and benevolent king. In fact, he was the king who allowed the Jews to go back to their homeland and to start to rebuild their home. And so under Zerubbabel and Ezra and others, they went back to their homeland and started to rebuild the temple and other things. Well, Cyrus's son was Darius. And Darius was a fairly good king as well. He was the king during the time of Daniel. And if you remember the story of Daniel being thrown in the lion's den, Darius was king at that point. He didn't want to throw Daniel in the lion's den. He kind of felt like he had to. But he was a fairly good king. Through both those kings, Cyrus and Darius, the Persian Empire grew extensively. There became a lot of power and authority and wealth in the empire. And so when Xerxes comes to the throne, he's got a lot at his disposal. He's got a lot of wealth. He's got a lot of power. But Xerxes was not quite as good of a king as Darius and Cyrus were. He got angry real easily, and he'd make rash decisions. He relied too much on his advisors, and he can never make up his own mind, and he can never tell someone no. There's this story that's written by a guy named Herodotus, who was a non-biblical historian, and he wrote about Xerxes. And he tells this story about how Xerxes built this bridge over a river. And there was a storm, and the river rose, and the bridge was destroyed. And Xerxes was so mad because he's the king, and he's supposed to get what he wants. And this bridge that he built has now been destroyed. And so what he did was he said all the engineers there to be executed who built that bridge. And then he said the river is going to receive 300 lashes from a whip. Now, I don't know what good it does to whip a river, but that's what Xerxes thought. He was self-focused. He was egotistical. He thought, I'm the king, and whatever I want, I'm going to get. Well, as we begin the story of Esther, we have this opening shot. We find out that the king, Xerxes, is hosting this banquet. A banquet that lasts 180 days, 6 months. I mean, that's some kind of party, right? He is brought to the king, to the capital of his kingdom, Susa, all of his princes, all of his military generals, all of the nobles throughout his 127 provinces. And then after that banquet, he has another banquet, which is 7 days long, and it's for everybody in the capital city. From the greatest to the least, everybody's invited to this party for 7 days. Now, what we think is going on, according to Herodotus and some other historians, is that what Xerxes is trying to do is he's bringing everybody to the capital city because he's trying to get everybody on board with his desire to attack Greece. Because twice in his reign, he tried to attack Greece. Twice he failed because it was a foolish thing to do. And we think that that might be what he's doing here. He's bringing everybody to the capital to try to convince them to do his plan. Well, what happens here in the first 8 verses is that it's almost as if the camera starts tracking through these banquets. And we get this very detailed picture of the wealth and the power of the king. And so, for example, it says in verse 4, for a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. And it says in that seven-day banquet that there was a garden that had hangings of white and blue linen. They were fastened to silver rings on marble pillars. It says there were couches of gold and silver. Anyone ever sat on a couch of gold or silver? And there was this mosaic pavement that was made of special and costly stones. The Hebrew words that are used in these verses are unique throughout the whole Old Testament. They aren't used any other place. Why? Because the writer is trying to help us see how unique the wealth and power of Xerxes was. It says that wine was served to anybody as much as he wanted, trying to show us that the king had as much as anybody could ever want. And that wine was served in goblets of gold, and every single goblet was different than the other one. You see the picture of this opening shot? The author's trying to give us this panoramic picture of here is how wealthy, and here is how powerful, and here is how much authority this man has, Xerxes. Now, this is kind of fascinating because there is no other book in the Bible that begins this way. There's no other book in the Bible that spends the first several verses detailing in intricate ways the power and wealth of a pagan king. Normally, books in the Bible begin by a detailed description of the power and majesty of God, right? Genesis, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Gospel of John, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him, all things were made that have been made. Nothing was made that has been made except through him. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. These are passages that display the glory and the majesty of God and his Son. Even in the book of Ezra, Ezra's very similar to Esther, is written in the same time frame, just a little bit earlier. And even the way it begins is different. Notice what it says here in Ezra 1, verse 1. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, the king of Persia. It mentions a pagan king as it begins, but it makes it very clear who's in charge. God is. He's the one moving the heart of Cyrus. But not Esther. Esther has 8 verses of detailed, unique descriptions of the wealth and power of Xerxes, and God is never mentioned. Why is that? And could it be that the reason why the author begins the story this way, is he's trying to help us understand the world that Esther lived in. A world where Xerxes, in many ways, was God. Sam Wells, in his commentary, puts this way. He says, Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, was God. That's how the book of Esther begins. The book begins with the one who's in charge of all the events and circumstances and arrangements and threats that affect the Jews. He holds the whole world in his hands. In Esther's world, nobody prayed what Nolan prayed. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done. In Esther's world, they prayed, our King who art in Susa, hallowed be your name. May Persia's kingdom come. May Xerxes' will be done. It was not a world where people honored God. It was not a world where people wanted to love their neighbor. It was a world where everyone got whatever they could get. It was a world where everyone pursued wealth, glory, and honor. It was a world where Xerxes was the center. In a word, it was a world that was secular. Secular. And some of us here today, we know what it's like to live in a secular world. We talked earlier about this being college day, and I know we've got some college students here this morning, and graduate school students, young adults. And some of you have grown up in Christian homes that have been very encouraging, and that have been very uplifting, and they've been homes that have honored God, and now you find yourself on a college campus, or in a dorm room, or in an apartment complex, and that is not the case at all. Everyone around you is pursuing selfish desires. Everyone around you is ungodly. Everyone around you is sleeping in on Sunday morning, and you find yourself in a secular world. There are some of us who experience that in our workplace, that maybe at one time in our life we were working in a Christian environment, some kind of job where it just seemed like everybody was Christians and everybody was uplifting and encouraging one another. Everyone was trying to do their work with integrity and everyone was trying to help one another. And now you find yourself in a work environment that is not that way at all, and where it seems that nobody around you has Christian values, and there's backbiting and there's everyone trying to get ahead. And no one helps one another. They just try to tend to their own business, and you find yourself in a secular world. In many ways, I think we could say that about every single one of us here, because previously in our nation, decades ago, it seemed as if, it may not have been true, but it seemed as if just everybody around us in our neighborhoods and around our country, they just, everybody went to church and everybody had the similar values and everyone kind of believed a lot of the same kinds of things. And now we find ourselves in a country that is largely secular. And in our neighborhoods and in our cities, there are people with many different values than us. And we find ourselves at odds with the world around us. This came home to me a few years ago when our family went up to upstate New York and we visited Don English up in Johnstown. At that time, our church was supporting Don and his family, and so we went to go visit him. And we went to Johnstown, and Johnstown, New York is an interesting town because its roots go back to the Revolutionary War era. And so Don took us on this tour of the old town. And at the center of that old town, do you know what was at the center of that old town? A church building. Because that was the center of that old community. It was faith and God. And everybody went to that church. That's where everybody in town gathered. And even there was a cemetery behind that church, and that's where everybody was buried. The founder of Johnstown is buried in that cemetery. And do you know how many people attend that church today? Zero. It's a museum. Nobody goes there anymore. It's empty. Well, we got back into Don's car. I said, well, take us to where your church building is. And we drive to the edge of town. And that's where the church building was, where Don preached. I thought, isn't this an interesting metaphor? At one time in our country, church and faith was kind of at the center of everything we did. It was kind of the center of our communities. Now, it's at the edge of town. We're on the margin of society now. And if you're going to be a faithful, radical disciple of Christ in your high schools, in your colleges, on college campuses, in your jobs, in your neighborhood, just get ready, because you're going to be the outsider. You're going to be on the outside looking in, and people are going to think you're a little bit strange because your values are going to be different than the values of the people around you. And whenever you find yourself in a secular world, it's so easy to fall in line and start to live in a secular way. After all, it's easy to look at the world and say, what I see must be the way that it really is. And if this is the way that everybody else is living, then maybe I should just start to live this way too, because that's what I see everybody else doing. And I think you can make an argument that this started to happen to Esther and Mordecai in the story, in the book of Esther. That because they were living in a secular world that revolved around King Xerxes, it seems as if they were influenced to start living a secular life. Did you know this, that nobody in the book of Esther prays? Nobody prays. Esther never prays. Mordecai never prays. Nobody offers a sacrifice to God in worship. Nobody quotes any scripture in the book of Esther. Mordecai and Esther, they never quote scripture. Nobody tells the stories of Abraham and David and the promises to the forefathers and the patriarchs. Nobody does that. Nobody talks about the good old days with David and Solomon. The only thing that is remotely spiritual that happens in the book is when Esther says, "Fast for me as I get ready to go to the king." That's the only thing remotely spiritual. In fact, Mordecai even tells Esther, "Hide your faith. Hide it. Don't let anybody know you have it." In many ways, it seems as if Mordecai and Esther had started to be influenced by the secular world around them, because it's so easy for that to happen. It is so easy to live in a secular world and to let that to influence us where we start living a secular life. I'm going to offer a little confession. Last night, I went to the TCU football game, and I rooted for Arkansas. And I'm confessing. And I was the minority. And there was a lot of TCU fans in front of me, and there was a lot of TCU fans behind me. And whenever TCU made a good play, they made sure that I knew that they were TCU fans. Of course, I was happy at the end of the game, but we won't talk about that. It's hard to stand out. It's hard to be different than the surrounding culture. It's hard to live in a secular world and be a faithful disciple of Jesus. It's hard to do that. It's so easy on the college campus when you see everybody else running after worldly things to just join in and run with them. It's so easy when you're in that secular work environment and you see everyone just doing what they can to get ahead and just not helping one another, not showing signs of humility and those kinds of things. It's just easy to join in and just do it with them. It's so easy to live in this country, and as we see the ways of culture move away from God and move away from Christian values, it's just so easy to just join in. I mean, that's what everybody else is doing. Might as well join them. And how do we, as children of God, as people of God, how do we stand our ground? How do we stay faithful in a secular environment? How do we stay true to Jesus, even when the influences around us, whether it's on the campus or in the halls of our high school, or whether it's in the work environments, when those influences are pushing us away from Jesus? How do we stand strong? And I think the answer is that we have to learn to see the world differently. To recognize that the way we see the world is not the way it really is. There's someone behind the scenes. You know, Xerxes thought that he was in control of everything. He thought that whatever he wanted, he got. He thought that what he said was reality. But when you get to the end of the story, you find out Xerxes isn't all what he cracked up to be. Let me give you the best example. He made a decree that on the 13th day of the month of Adar, the Jewish people would be annihilated. And when the king makes a decree, nothing can change the decree because he's king and he's in control of everything. But you get to the end of the story, and what happens? That decree has been overturned, and the Jews are not annihilated. The Jews thrive. Why? Because God was actually in control. I like the way one person put it. They said, what appears to be the preeminent mover and shaker in the eyes of the Middle Eastern world is in reality no more than a mere pawn in the hands of the omnipotent God. This is just one example of a myriad of examples that we could talk about through history where there have been kings and there have been queens and there have been princes. And there have been prime ministers and there have been presidents who have thought that they were the ones in charge, and they were the ones, by their word and by their action, the world changed, when in reality, that was not true. God was on his throne, and God is in control. I like the way the psalmist puts it in Psalm chapter 2. The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against his anointed one. Let us break their chains, they say, and throw off their fetters. And the one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Xerxes thought, with all of my wealth and with all my 127 provinces, I can do whatever I want. I can decree whatever I want. And God just laughed. He laughed. Because he sits on the throne of heaven. And he is over all. And he reigns supreme. And that is true. And when we understand that truth, it causes us to look at the world differently. And what we see in the world, we say, you know, that's not really true. And it gives us the courage and it gives us the hope to stand our ground. And when we see everyone running after whatever's happening in our world, we stand up and we say, that's not true. That's not real. This is what's real, following Jesus and submitting to God. And so I want to encourage us this morning. I want to encourage our college students and young adults. When you find yourself in that secular world and everybody's running after the things of this world, stand strong for Jesus. Because you know what really is true. And offer the love of Christ and the truth of Christ and demonstrate your faith. And for those of us that are working in that secular work environment, when you see everybody doing things the way the world says to do them, stand strong for Jesus and seek the way of humility. Seek the way of mercy. Seek the way of forgiveness. And for all of us who are living in a world, a nation that is largely becoming secular, we need to stand strong for Jesus. And not run after the American dream, but hold on to the kingdom of God dream. Because that's what's real. And to follow Christ. Hans Christian Andersen was a famous Danish writer. And one of his more famous stories is called The Emperor's New Clothes. It's kind of a funny story about this emperor who thinks that he has all power and all wealth and all everything. And so he hires two weavers to make some clothes for him to wear. And he says, I want these clothes to be so good that everyone's just going to admire me and just think I am so cool. And so these weavers come back to him and said, okay, we've made these special clothes for you, but they're a little bit different. You can only see them if you're really bright and really intellectual and just really popular. And if you are kind of dumb and, you know, just not very good, you can't see them. Okay? And so the king, he didn't see the clothes, but he didn't want to admit that he didn't see them because he didn't want to act like he's dumb, right? And so he says, oh, well, these look really nice. You know, let's put them on. You know, so he puts on these invisible clothes. And he starts strutting around, and everyone starts oohing and, oh, very nice clothing, king, because they don't want to be viewed as dumb or unimportant. They just want to go along with the king until finally a child blurts out, he's naked. He doesn't have anything on. You know, in the story of Esther, everybody wanted to run along with Xerxes. Because that was their world. That's who they thought everything revolved around. Let's just do what Xerxes wants because he's the one with all the power. But actually, that wasn't real. It was invisible. And what was truly real was that God is in heaven and God is in control and God is over all. And everything we see in our world, that our world runs after, it's not real, folks. The American wealth or the wealth of any empire, it's not real. The sinful pleasures that people run after, it's not real. It's just fluff. You want to know what's real? Real is that God created you and made you in his image. Real is that God sent his son to die for you. Because he loved you so much. Real is that we can join him in his redemptive mission in the world. Real is that we have a home in the new heaven and new earth. And we're going there someday. That's what's real. And can we hold on to what's real in the midst of a secular world? The first step to giving our life to Jesus and to following what is real is being baptized into Christ. And baptism, you know, what you see of baptism isn't really what it is. You see it, think someone's just dunked underwater. There's so much more going on. God's behind the scenes, and he's forgiving that person of their sins. He's making them new. He's saving them. He's adding them to the church. God's at work through all of that. And if you're ready to take that step, we're going to sing a song of invitation. You can come to the front during this song, and we'd love to baptize you. Or maybe you need prayer this morning. Maybe you need encouragement this morning. Maybe there's something on your heart that you need to bring before the Lord, some struggle that you're going through. We're going to have elders surround this auditorium and ministers. And again, what we see is not really the way it is. It's not just people standing, close their eyes, saying words. But God's Spirit is moving at that moment. He's healing his people and restoring his people in the struggles that they're going through. And so if you need that healing, if you need that encouragement, please come now. Let's stand. Let's sing at this time.